Turn to Ephesians chapter 4. And we're going to be reading the first six verses. In this chapter, Paul makes a turn, and if you study the letters of Paul, you'll find that this is a pattern that is common in his letters, that he begins his letters with the doctrine of the gospel, typically, and with doctrine more generally, and ends with practical instruction of how we are to live. So the flow in the letter from beginning to end is, here is what is true, and therefore, here is how you are to respond. Here is how you are to live. And so this chapter here is the transition in Ephesians from where he is giving teaching on what is true to being focused much more on what we are to do because of what he has already taught us. So it'll be helpful if you keep in mind what we have heard in the prior chapters as we read these first six verses of Ephesians 4. Therefore, I, the prisoner of the Lord, implore you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling with which you have been called, with all humility and gentleness, with patience, showing tolerance for one another in love, being diligent to preserve the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. There is one body and one Spirit, just as also you were called in one hope of your calling, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is over all and through all and in all. This is the word of the Lord. So Paul begins this chapter with the instruction that we are to walk in a manner worthy of the calling with which we have been called. Walk in a manner worthy of the calling. He ends this little paragraph by talking about our God and Father. And so what I want to draw your attention to right at the beginning here is that we've heard all about this calling in the previous three chapters, right? And now, as he begins to urge us to live in a particular way, he's relying on our remembering what he's said about that calling, that it's a glorious calling, that it's given to us as a wonderful gift. Even though we were not his people, we have become his people, that this is such a sweet and precious gift from him. And so, as he gives us these instructions, you'll find that the list of behaviors of what it looks like for us to walk in a manner that is worthy of that precious calling that we have received, you'll find that they're very familiar. In fact, if you think about the fruit of the Spirit, you'll see a lot of overlap in this passage. And so again, Paul often repeats himself in his letters, reminding us of the things that we need to hear over and over and over, that we need to be reminded of and instructed on day by day. So, to walk in a manner worthy of the calling with which you have been called, as we see in verse 1, is to walk in a manner worthy of the one who called you. Verse 6. The calling comes from him, from the Father. And so I want you to think about not just the fact that you have been called, changing how you therefore behave, but who is the one who called you? Who is the one who called you? To walk in a manner worthy of your calling depends on you knowing who called you and what he is like. When you see that it is the holy, one, true God, our Father, that called us, and when we remember what we've seen of and learned about that Father in previous chapters, in fact, just in the previous verses, right? Then all of a sudden, we see the inspiration behind him starting this chapter with, therefore, and urging us to, imploring us to walk in a manner that's worthy of that calling. Because we remember that it was our Father who has given us this sweet, precious, unexpected calling. This is not at all like the Greek gods. When we study the Iliad or the Odyssey, when we read the works of Homer or Aeneas, what we find is that the Greeks had a very, very different conception of the gods. What was it like to be a Greek with lots of different gods instead of one God? Maybe some of you kids can answer. What kinds of troubles came from the fact that there were lots of gods? Have any of you read enough Greek mythology or Greek stories to find out what kinds of bad things happen because there's lots of gods? Yeah, you got one, Liam? Yeah, you got to sacrifice to all of them. And if you miss one, then who knows what might happen. But likely that one will get mad at you. Yeah, you got one? They all fight and what? And parts of the world get destroyed. Yeah, it's a problem, right? Tate's been reading and studying. What have you been, where is he? What have you been reading? Both the Iliad and the Odyssey. That's why I was confused. And one of the things that he points out is that the gods keep intervening in the battle that's taking place at Troy. The gods keep intervening. So, you know, one side will be about to win, and then all of a sudden, one of the gods will step in and mess with things, and oh, tip the balance back the other direction, and tip the balance back the other, and another one steps in. And why? Well, because they're all at odds with each other. There isn't one God. There isn't unity in Mount Olympus, right? There's an infinite number of gods and sub-gods and children of half-gods, and all that have power to interfere and to intervene in ways that cause problems, whereas we have one God and Father. One God and Father. There is only one, and there is no conflict between the desires of the persons in the Trinity. Therefore, to glorify the Son is to glorify the Father, and he doesn't take offense that you've sacrificed, that you've glorified the Son, and feel like he's somehow being left out. No, to glorify one is to glorify the God. Because he came from the Father. What a gift this is to have that unity such that it is perfectly clear what it ought to look like for us to live according to that God in a manner that is worthy of his calling that he has given us. And you don't have to worry about if, you know, you've got some patron saint of this that you've really been attached to, you know, patron saint of traveling, and then wonder, well, maybe I haven't given enough attention to the patron saint of what am I about to do? Right? You know, oh, well, maybe I should quick give some more attention over here. No, there is a manner of walking that is straightforward and clear, that is worthy of our calling and who our calling comes from, our Father. In fact, the reason that our calling is glorious is because it is the Father who is the one who did it. That's why our calling is amazing. To be chosen by somebody in this world is really not that special. But to be chosen by God, our Heavenly Father, is a remarkable, glorious gift. It is a glorious calling. And so our calling is special, and therefore we are to walk in a manner that is worthy of that calling from that one God. So what does then the Apostle Paul say in terms of what that looks like? And I say it's simple, it's straightforward, it's obvious, but I don't say it's easy, right? Easy to understand, yes. Not quite so easy to do, is it? To walk in a manner that is worthy of our calling and of our Father. Well, he gives us a list here. He gives us this list as he is constantly reminding the Ephesians as a prisoner of the Lord. He brings that back up in verse 1. As a prisoner of the Lord. Why does he keep bringing that up? I think in this case, part of the reason is to remind us that he has walked in a manner that is worthy of this calling, and that his being in prison isn't a result of his bad behavior, but is in fact a result of the fact that he has walked according to this calling. And so that's why he calls himself a prisoner of the Lord, not a prisoner of the Romans, not a prisoner of the governor, not a prisoner because of the persecution of the Jews. All those things are true. But the reality is that he is a prisoner of the Lord because he has walked according to this calling. In other words, he's reminding them, I have lived it. I have done this. Now walk with me in it. Even though, yes, it leads to prison in some cases. Now, how could walking in a manner that's worthy lead to prison? Let's look at the list, and we might get even more confused. How could these things lead to prison? What is his list? Humility. With all humility. That's where he starts. Humility, if you think about it as a starting point, right? Humility, he leads off with, because you were not called because you're awesome. A manner worthy of your calling. We're connecting our calling into this, right? So if we're starting out thinking about our calling, and then he says humility, we're reminded in Romans and elsewhere, you know, you were just grafted in to the tree. And if you get proud, you can get cut right back out again. So don't get all uppity. Don't get all proud. Don't think we're amazing. We've been chosen instead of the Jews. No, no, no. You've just been grafted in. You haven't been chosen because of anything remarkable or amazing or glorious in you. You've been chosen by him, and so he gets the glory. And so it requires us to start out humble, doesn't it? Thinking about who God is and who we are and thinking, why would he choose us? I guess I best start out humble. So our starting point is one of humility before God, yes. But if you think about walking in a manner that's humble, you know that this doesn't just refer to your relationship with God, does it? Humility also, and probably primarily, causes us to think about our relationship and our interactions with one another, with other people, with those that are around us. Because although pride before the Lord is certainly a danger and a major problem for all of us, it's less obvious to us when we're being proud before the Lord. And we look around and we see people being proud in front of other people all the time. We look around at ourselves and we think, I can't believe that I was acting that way. I can't believe I thought I was so smart. I can't believe I thought I was so well-read. I can't believe I thought I was so well-connected. I can't believe I thought any of that meant anything. So our humility before the Lord extends then out into our relationship with other people. And we end up seeing that it's impossible for us to feel superior to our fellow called ones. The other people who have been called have also been called. They're also unworthy. But we are remembering first and foremost that we were unworthy. And so, how can we feel superior to others? The very fact that we have been called could be a reason for us to think we are superior, right? But humility is where he starts, reminding us that actually, as we saw in the first couple of chapters in particular, reminding us how little we had to do with it. In fact, in the measure, it was no percent. It was God from the beginning. And so this demands that we end up being humble before one another. This is what it starts out as, humility. Walking in a manner worthy of this calling that we have been given requires us to remember where that calling came from and who it came from. And why? God, who is holy and we are not, that's humbling. Why? Not because of anything that you have done or anything special in you. That's humbling. Okay. So we start out humble. We start out with humility if we're going to walk. If you listen to people talk when receiving an award or having won a game, they often say, I'm just so humbled to be here today, right? Have you ever heard this? Anybody? Okay. I'm just so humbled to be here today. Now, that's shallow, and typically they're not humble, right? And that's what's funny about most times that that's said. And yet, are they wrong to start with humility at that point? they're really not wrong to start with humility at that point. To start having received an award, to start having been victorious in your career, in your game, in whatever, and to just think, I can't believe that I am here. That's where we ought to start with our calling. What have we received? It's glorious. It's marvelous. We're at the top of our game. How could we have gotten anything better? We couldn't have anything better. So, wow. I can't believe I'm here. I'm just so humbled to be here. But it requires us to actually be humble, not humble brag. Not look where I got. I can't believe I'm here. Look where I am. I have the calling. Me. You see how that's the falseness of those. I'm just so humbled to be here today. No, we can't do that with our calling. Where does he go after humility? Gentleness. All these things that he speaks of connect to one another because they flow from that same Holy Spirit who has one character. And so when you see the relationship between gentleness and humility and patience and tolerance for one another, which is this list, right? You begin to realize how uniting and how united these things are. Gentleness. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on gentleness, except to think about how humility causes you to be more gentle with your brothers and your sisters. I'm just going to sort of draw out the relationship between these rather than emphasize what gentleness looks like and spend a lot of time on that. Why do you end up gentle if you have humility? You end up gentle because you realize how often you have been in the same spot as your sister. In the way. And so instead of barging through her, in your humility, you are gentle. Because you recognize, I also have often been in the way. In your humility, you recognize how often you also have sinned. And so you are gentle in your correction of others, right? This is the way that elders are exhorted to correct others, is with gentleness. Humility leads straight into gentleness and patience. Patience, which is also very similar to gentleness. We see humility leading to patience for exactly the same reasons. I'll be patient with those who are causing me to be late. I'll be patient remembering how often people have waited for me and I have made them late. Right? You see how humility about yourself causes you to be patient with others in their weaknesses and in their failings. Which is not to say that they aren't failings. They should have been putting their shoes on. They should have been getting ready. They should have been paying attention to the time. These are all failings that I have. that you have. In our humility, we recognize, oh yes, it's, I remember from as a kid, the song Have Patience. Have you guys ever heard that one? I think it was from Salty the Singing Songbook. Have patience. Have patience. Don't be in such a hurry. And what does it say? When you get impatient, you only start to worry. Remember that God is patient too. And think of all the other times that people wait for you. What a lesson. And now you see the character of God, who is the one who called us, and you see that walking in a manner worthy of his calling means us being like him, having that patience that he has for us. That God is patient too is why us living in a manner that is worthy of our calling looks like us being patient. And that humility of seeing how others put up with us, so surely we can put up with them. But more than that, and most of all, that God puts up with us patiently. And so surely we don't want to be like the wicked servant that, having been forgiven much, is unwilling to forgive little to his brother, right? And this is straight into the next part of Paul's list, tolerance for one another. Now, what does tolerance for one another imply? Similarly to patience, it implies that the other person has done something that is not quite ideal, or is a certain way that's not quite ideal, right? I say has done or is because I want us to recognize how broad tolerance actually is. Now, I know that tolerance is a bad word among conservatives. But here we have this command from God that we are to be tolerant towards one another, right? Showing tolerance for one another in love. People will sin against you. That's something they do, right? And, or, be generally offensive to you. And that might be something that they are. Now, how could somebody be generally offensive without sinning against you? Well, maybe they smell bad. Can you be tolerant? Well, in love. In love you can, right? Tolerance for one another actually requires that we have real love. Tolerance that isn't filled with love is something very different. Tolerance that isn't filled with love is what the liberals are pushing when they push tolerance. Okay? When they're pushing tolerance, it's from a position of superiority and pride. And from the outside, sometimes it can look somewhat similar. We use the same word, right? But to tolerate somebody without love because you think well of yourself and you think that that makes you good is not what he's talking about here, is it? Tolerating in pride is the opposite of tolerance that flows out of humility and is built in to love. And so the in love part here is essential for us to recognize truly what he's talking about. Tolerating one another. Well, showing tolerance. Showing tolerance includes a lot of things. Now, I focused a little bit on the what they're like. Maybe they have a bad sense of humor. Maybe they tell terrible jokes. Maybe they don't know when to shut up. Maybe they, and there's, I will grant, it's not quite clear where the line is from what they are versus sinning, right? Some of these things flow out of sin and become what people are. A lack of self-control or a lack of self-discipline can lead to people smelling or talking too much. The line is not perfectly clear. Nevertheless, tolerance is broad enough to cover both, and that's why it doesn't really matter which side you're talking about. Tolerance in love is one of the many reasons why we have small groups, so that you can tolerate one another. Now, it requires that you tolerate one another, because in small groups are when you have the opportunity to be sinned against, to be irritated, to find out whether you actually love them or whether you tolerate them in pride, secretly looking down on them. And we get to learn and practice walking in accordance with our calling. This is one of the many places in the New Testament where you read this phrase, one another. Over and over and over and over again in the New Testament, you see this one another with these kinds of commands. You cannot do them if you don't spend time with one another. So that's why I say this is why we have small groups, so that we can love one another. Or maybe to put it another way, if you aren't willing to even spend time with one another, there is an obvious lack of love that you need to ask yourself what is missing in your walking in a manner worthy of the calling. Right? If you don't even want to spend time with each other, is there something lacking there? Why, yes, as a matter of fact, there is. So what is it? What is it in you that indicates I'd rather not? What is it in you that pushes you away from other people? And you say, well, it's not me, it's them. They stink. They're never on time. They take forever. They don't bring good food. I want to go do this. Oh, wait, that one is me. Right? I want to go do this. That's the selfishness that is different from this manner of walking that's worthy of the calling. Look at what Christ has done for us. And so all of these things that we've been through this list now come to a conclusion in preserving unity. Preserving unity. So verse 3 says, being diligent to preserve the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. In Colossians, the Apostle Paul, while urging unity to the church in Colossus? Is it Colossus? Colossus? It's just, sorry, I'm lost. That church, you know the one he wrote the Colossians letter to. While he's urging them to unity, the same as he does to this church in Ephesians, whatever that place is, he says this, beyond all these things, put on love, which is the perfect bond of unity. So I read this verse Beyond all these things, put on love, which is the perfect bond of unity. Because I want you to see where he's talking here in verse 3 about preserving the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. That bond, that bond of peace that he speaks of isn't necessarily obvious what he's talking about to me. Preserve unity in the bond of peace is very easy to turn into Christianese, right? But in the letter to the Colossians, we have that simple explanation that love is the perfect bond of unity. So what is a bond? Well, it's like glue, right? Stuck together. Bonded. The perfect bond. Now, there's bondage, too, which, again, you're stuck, right? Same root word. Being diligent to preserve the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. And love being the perfect bond of unity. So love comes right before there, tolerance for one another in love, being diligent to preserve the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. Now in Colossians 3:15, the very next verse, I've read you the one. He continues, he says, let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, to which indeed you were called in one body, and be thankful. So we see the same exact theme in Colossians as we see here in Ephesians. Unity, that oneness, one body. It's a beautiful thing. What does this mean, then, for us to preserve unity? Well, it requires that we start with love, the same as that gentleness, with that humility, with that tolerance for one another. Preserving unity, you can think about what that looks like in the church and in your own home. And in the context of humility, gentleness, peace, love, you begin to realize, oh, okay, unity is going to look a particular way. That perfect bond of peace flows out of the fact that we have love for one another in the home. And so therefore, we do not fight, we do not argue, because we have one purpose, one goal, and we love one another. So unity requires us to have that love, but also to have that one purpose, that same goal. And yet, he doesn't just say having unity or being united. He says preserving unity. It's something that you actually have to fight to keep. And then he actually goes a step further and says with diligence. With diligence, we have to do the work of preserving unity, which indicates how easy it is for us to lose unity. Even if we have love for one another, it can be easy for us to lack unity. And so it requires diligence for us to pursue that, to preserve it. It's not enough to simply not intentionally be insulting and offensive. Right? Now, some of you need to be told, look, to be intentionally insulting, to be putting people down, to be calling them names, all of this is the opposite of preserving unity. So stop. Right? Stop. It's also important to remember that to be easily offended is also quick to destroy unity, right? Because you can bet that people will intentionally and unintentionally be mean and rude to you. But will you tolerate them in love and seek to preserve the unity that ought to be there? That's hard, isn't it? But to be easily offended is just as much destructive of unity as to be offensive is destructive of unity. To be quick to take offense is the opposite of love, if we go to the love chapter in Corinthians, right? Quick to take offense. No, that's destructive of unity. So on both sides, we've got, you know, you can't intentionally be insulting if you want unity, and you can't have an unwillingness to forgive, an unwillingness to overlook. You can't have thin skin and be easily offended if you want unity. So on both of those, I then add and say, actually, that's still not enough to be described as diligently preserving unity. To not have those things is a good first step, but to diligently preserve is actually something more active than not offending, not taking offense. To diligently preserve unity actually requires us to proactively make peace, to seek, to find ways that others can be united. To be a peacemaker is part of what it means to be diligently preserving unity. If you think about how much work it takes for a home, for fathers and mothers, to keep unity in the household, you realize that this takes active, continuous work. And so that's why the urge to diligence is part of what it looks like for us to walk according to this calling, that we are diligently seeking to produce unity, protect unity, fight for unity. Now, it's at this point that I have to remind you, and that you'll see it most easily, having thought about the home, that preserving unity is often disciplining error. Preserving unity often means disciplining error, okay? Just like preserving unity in the home requires telling people, no, you are not going off and doing your own thing. We are all together doing this, right? Or no, you may not hit, punch, insult, all those things, but we will love, right? So in the church, it requires us to recognize diligence in preserving unity requires saying, no, that is false doctrine. You will not teach it here, right? No, no. How often is the Apostle Paul telling us, no, don't give in to the Judaizers. No, they will destroy your unity. You will have a split body. But we have one faith, one body. That's what he's arguing against, right? And so him seeking this unity, being diligent to preserve it, is what he's doing right now by fighting against the Judaizers who want to say, well, you know, the Gentiles and the Jews are still really, you know, and if the Gentiles really want the full blessing, they're going to have to go ahead and make some sacrifices. And so that they can be in, which can sound very good. Hey, look, they want them to be in. They want unity. And Paul's going, no, no, they don't want unity. They are dividing the body. He's being diligent to preserve unity. So diligence in preserving unity, I'm just trying to drive home that point that it's hard work, that's why it requires diligence, and that it's not enough to simply stop being offensive and stop being easily offended. It actually requires you to put together a vision for what you're heading towards. That's the unity that we are seeking. And where does that unity come from? It turns out that unity is an objective reality. We are seeking to preserve what already exists and has been created by God. The unity that we have is precisely because there is only one God, and we are serving that one God. So any who would seek to divide people from the one church, the one faith, the one body, our one Lord, they are the ones who must be opposed as we seek to preserve diligently the unity that has been created by the fact that there is one calling. Just one calling from one God. We have one Father. There is one church. One baptism. There is not the Jewish church and the Gentile church. One church. One body. He's driving that point home again, right? If we are willing to acknowledge others as Christians, if we look at somebody and say, oh yeah, they're a Christian, then we must not look down on them. So, you know, you go back through the list again. All of a sudden, you have to have humility towards them. You have to have gentleness, even if they require correction, right? You have to be united with them. We can't be proud that we have the true knowledge. We can be thankful that we may have something that God has given to us to share with the body. Praise God for that. Do you think maybe they have something to share with the body too? As a matter of fact, that's where Paul goes next. So we'll study that later. That's just a sneak peek to our next sermon. But our baptism, our spirit, our body, our faith, our Lord, our one calling flow from the fact that we have one Father. And that is why we are seeking that unity. That's why that is a manner, walking in a manner worthy of our calling. Because our calling comes from one, and it is one calling to his one people that he has united. So it's an objective reality that we are seeking to preserve to the end. Not something that, you know, we can take or leave. Not something that is entirely a construct of our culture and our commitments that we're going to somehow create. No, God created this unity. And so we can't have an attitude towards one another in the body, towards those who are outside this body and in the larger body, that leaves us unwilling and unable to be united with them. But it also requires that we know where the lines are to draw who is part of this body. This is why the church has had a historical emphasis on distinguishing between heresy and other error. Where is the line of heresy? Because that is where we are not united with them. They are not part of the one church. they worship a different God. And all of a sudden, the unity has a lot more meaning when you realize, oh, it's not just this universal tolerance, it's oneness in Christ's body. That's what we're seeking. That's what we're pursuing, because we have one Father.